From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capital Notes podcast for Friday, April 2nd, the day after April Fool's Day. You were supposed to weigh in there by phone, Anthony.
I was. Well, but yeah, I was. I know I was supposed to, but I didn't. See, April Fool's.
This just doesn't work as well when you're not here in the studio with me.
No, the magic is gone.
Yeah. I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio, and by phone, the magic of telephonic services.
High tech. Very high tech.
Is Anthony York, the editor of Capital Weekly, who is in Los Angeles, our Los Angeles studio.
Yes, yes. The LA Bureau.
You're not at
the Capital Weekly, the Capital Notes podcast, and the Los Angeles Times.
There you go. Are you at? Are you actually in LA, or are you at the Voyeur Club in West Hollywood?
What do you think I am, a member of the Republican National Committee?
And if you don't get that joke, folks, then you're listening to the wrong podcast.
Yes.
So obviously we're at different ends of the great state of California today to talk about politics for this week, and not a heck of a lot to talk about since it is spring break at the state capitol.
Legislators, that's not going to stop us, though, is it?
No, but I was going to say legislators gone wild.
Woohoo!
Which actually is what happens normally, some critics would say.
Yes.
So we have no spring break, although actually, Anthony, I guess in L.A. is semi-spring break. And so not
actually, not anymore. I'm trying to purge this image that you've planted in my head of legislators gone wild. Thank you very much.
It was the least I could do.
Yes.
Not a tremendous amount of political news this week, but a few things to talk about. And thanks to another podcast listener, for the end of the podcast was, face it, we didn't know what we would talk about. And thank you to the person who wrote in. You know, we actually have a few listeners.
I know. And who, illiterate listeners.
Yeah.
Literate listeners. Not illiterate, sorry.
And they always hate that we joke that we only have four or five. But anyway. All right. Well, be that as it may, I think first off we were going to talk about a little bit about some of the maneuvering that's going on the statewide level. In some of the campaigns, more specifically, the maneuvering that goes on about campaign finance issues and the way they're run, and is somebody playing by the rules? And inevitably, people run to the political watchdog of the state, the Fair Political Practices Commission. And so we've seen the FPPC come back with, I don't know, two or more, Anthony, thanks but no thanks renderings or writings in the last few days.
Yeah, well, you know, this is sort of the stage in the campaign where they do run to the Fair Political Practices Commission simultaneously, and then very soon after they run to the press, right? And they try to get coverage for their allegations that they're making against one campaign or the other. There were two instances in recent days on the statewide level, and a number of examples on the legislative races as well. But the two big ones, there was a complaint filed by the Meg Whitman campaign against Level the Playing Field, one of these independent expenditure committees that has formed, and it was a wide-ranging complaint. Number one was that they were improperly organized as a committee, and number two was that Jerry Brown's statement to a union group a couple of weeks ago that he wanted the unions to attack and give money, this somehow amounted to undue coordination between Jerry Brown and the independent expenditures. And the FPPC said,
No.
So that was very quickly shot down. The other complaint was in the lieutenant governor's race. And this was actually an interesting case. Janice Hahn, Democrat from city councilwoman from Los Angeles, was charging that Gavin Newsom, mayor of San Francisco, who's also running for lieutenant governor, should not be able to raise money from donors who have already given more than the state limit to Newsom when Newsom was running for governor. So basically saying that per election actually means per cycle. So the statewide max for lieutenant governor is $6,500. That's the maximum contribution you can give to one candidate. And Hahn was saying, well, anybody who's given more than $6,500 to Newsom in his race for governor should therefore be ineligible to give to Newsom for lieutenant governor.
Which would be a lot of donors because the maximum threshold for the gubernatorial race is much higher.
Yes, much higher, about three, four times as high, roughly. And once again, the FPPC said...
No. That must be my job here in this part.
No. Yes, you're the no. Yeah, if this were, you know, like a bigger... You're studio audience or the Greek chorus. I don't know what you are there, but you know, the FCPC, I mean, look, this is some of these are real complaints. A lot of these are just meant to sort of dominate the day's news cycle. And so even if the FCPC rejects the complaints, sometimes they have the desired effect of getting a news story or two on a specific topic and helping to sow some early seeds in the campaign narratives as we head towards Election Day.
Well, you know, certainly not to to reject the Whitman campaign's complaint against the independent expenditure group of Democrats and labor unions. But of the two that you mentioned, the Han Newsom one seems to me a little more substantive for the simple reason that should Han have prevailed in that and the FPPC say, you're right, that would have really hampered Newsom's ability to raise money and run the race.
Right, that's true. Although on the Whitman complaint, should be noted that part of the reason that the first part of their claim was denied, the part about level the playing field, was that soon after the complaint was filed, level the playing field actually refiled their paperwork and changed the type of committee that they were, which affected the disclosure timeline and things like that. And so they're. Their complaint was actually addressed by the campaign by the committee itself, and so that was part of the reason why the FPPC didn't act. Was they ruled that the committee had acted in a timely fashion?
They effectively had to like rejigger their committee and say we are now officially an anti-Meg Whitman committee.
Right, we're not a general purpose committee. We are a primarily formed anti-Meg Whitman committee, and that's a different category of committee under the state law. You have different requirements when it comes to disclosing where your money is coming from and how you're spending it. Although now we're in the window where you know we're in the 24-hour reporting, right? So I mean, all the money is showing up all the time now.
Yeah, we're all constantly clicking refresh on the Secretary of State's website to the point where like it crashed by midweek. I kept looking for money from Meg Whitman, which is what we should talk about next, because of a story I was working on. Let's talk about the gubernatorial race and money for a minute. We're all sitting there waiting for her to drop more money in her campaign. Admit it. You're like me. You keep waiting. You keep clicking that, too, to see when she writes the next check, right?
Well, you know, I have to give kudos to our friends at the San Jose Mercury News, whoever writes the headlines there this week.
the headline,
Meg Whitman running out of campaign cash. And I think it was clear from the story that it was a tongue-in-cheek headline because and the point was that at her current rate of spending, the $4.5 million that Whitman had in the bank was due to run out in 11 days. But it was a way of getting at the issue of Whitman's spending and also raising the question of when she would be writing herself another check. I thought it was very clever. You know, I got a chuckle out of it. Whitman herself late this week said she would make another, my favorite euphemism of the campaign so far, she would make another incremental investment in her campaign. And now, whatever that may mean.
Well, the problem is how do you define incremental? It depends on who you are and how much money you have.
Exactly. No, that's why it's such a beautiful term of art.
Yes.
I got a chuckle. I find humor where others find none. What can I say?
For me, when I call PG&E and tell them I'm going to make an incremental payment on what I owe, that's about $3. For Ms. Whitman, the former eBay CEO, whose personal wealth is valued at about $1.3 billion, I have a feeling incremental might mean something different.
Something with about six more zeros.
Though truth be told, I mean, you know, one of the things we watch, and this gets into what I wanted to talk about a little bit about the issue of the money and a story that I filed for the California Report and actually filed a version for the national folks at NPR.
And can I hear it online anywhere?
You can, NPR.org and CaliforniaReport.org. Okay. But thank you for that plug, Mr. York. But what I think is interesting about this is there is some interest in watching how much more she puts out at the beginning and how long it takes her through, how much more of it adds to the press coverage of how much she's spending. And again, you and I talked about this last week, and this you know, probably is what helped me write the story I did. Thank you. Which goes to this notion of at what point does it become part of the narrative of the campaign? Does it fight the narrative of the campaign? And the reason that that really seemed timely this week is because the Whitman campaign last weekend put out a television commercial that has her talking about that the state needs to do more with less, you know, and that she wants to go in and do more with less, which stands in stark contrast to the way she's running her campaign.
Yes, that is true.
And so, you know, at some point, you know, one would wonder, you know, will the voters pay attention to that at some point? Might they pay attention to it? Not just because reporters ask the question, because at a certain point, it's a disconnect from the lives they're living right now in these tough economic times, and certainly the state government is living.
Yeah, although I think that, you know, that hypocrisy, potential hypocrisy, at least seen through a campaign lens, is a potential problem. I think that, you know, Whitman's spending raises the bar for her to prove that she is someone of substance. If there's a perception that she's just trying to buy the election and that she's somehow not otherwise qualified, that her bank account is her only qualification to be governor, that's going to be a problem. Although, if the rest of the media continues to be as fawning as George Skelton is, apparently three glowing columns in, I don't know, a two-week span here in the Los Angeles Times about how Meg Whitman, you know, does her homework and how she's studied up and is more substantive than her campaign would allow you to believe, at least initially.
Well, one of the things that's one of the interesting things about that, and George, who's a longtime columnist and a very sharp fellow, and
the
also
dean, the dean of the Capitol Press Corps,
very much the dean of the press corps, and also not willing, also not afraid to call somebody out when they need it. But what I think is interesting is that they did a long sit down interview with George, and it clearly has paid off. And the last column, we're on a sidebar here, but bear with us, podcast people.
That's
but
awesome.
You know, the last column that you're referring to, Anthony, the one that I think came out on Wednesday of this week,
Thursday,
the
water bond.
Yeah, the water bond one, which was actually a very interesting substantive point in there, which maybe she has, maybe she did have her folks help her dig down through some of the things she could do. She was, if you didn't read the column, the point of it was, you know, she believes she could, as governor, line item veto out of it things that she considers to be pork if the voters pass it in November.
Yeah, although, you know, reading between the lines there, the part that she has the power to cut are the pieces that the Republicans wanted, essentially the water storage pieces. The rest of it, all the money that, the stuff that's referred to as pork, the money that went to all the conservancies and stuff, that stuff is still subject to legislative appropriation and cannot be unilaterally cut by the governor. So, look, I don't want to get,
yep.
We didn't want to have a detailed discussion about the water bond here, but...
Come on, let's do it.
But, I mean, that point jumped out at me as a stupid policy wonk, you know, when I was reading George's column Thursday morning.
All right. Well, so but let's go back to the more the
let's go to the shallower
let's go back
horse race.
I was going to say let's go back to the shallow horse race stuff. Just on the money issue, the other thing that I that came out in the reporting I did, and I think it's a, you know, these are all theories at this point, but these are all people who watch politics, and I wanted to put it out here on the table for a moment, and let's see you reject it, Anthony. But and it came out from one of the analysts I talked to that said, if, in fact, the Whitman campaign spending becomes an issue that the voters start to dial into, it may not be the level of spending that becomes a source of discussion as much as it is the way the money is spent. And the example was put out is, you know, if she was spending this money on a grassroots organization, organizing in different communities, frankly, similar to what President Obama did in the presidential race of, you know, organizing these people in you know, areas to knock on doors and do the work and whatever, that might be perceived one way. But the way the money has been spent so far is largely this political consultants, advertising, travel, things like that, that may not play as favorably if you're an average Joe.
And I think that it is sort of, you know, it's again drawing the connection between that and how she would govern. If she's a profligate spender as a campaigner and isn't, you know, how does that undermine her credibility to talk about reining in state spending and talk about, and that this, you know, as you were saying before, the state should do more with less and spend its money wisely? Well, if she doesn't demonstrate any ability to do that, and she's spending money on things that are seen as frivolous or counterproductive to her election efforts, then yeah, that's a problem for her. But, you know, I think thus far, it is early, but I don't think that the Democrats' efforts to sort of get, or Steve Poizner's efforts to get that narrative going, for whatever the reason, I don't feel like they've really taken hold yet. And, you know, we have, look, it's early days yet. If you assume, you know, this is a campaign through November, not through June, it's early. But I haven't seen any sign that narrative is going to stick to Meg Whitman.
Well, and here's the final question or point that I would raise on this before we go to the other topic, and that just is, it seems like it depends partly, too, on when the Whitman campaign decides to pivot. And that is, and I'm not saying that they're going to, maybe I shouldn't say they'll pivot completely, but this notion of, do they continue to run a race about the June 8th primary, or given that they are 50 points up in the last poll, are they pivoting to run a race against Jerry Brown and beginning the general election campaign? And in some sense, the Whitman campaign says they're running both right now, but you've got to think that, to me, I've got to think that the pivot is coming sooner rather than later. You know, with all due respect to Steve Poizner, the poll numbers haven't changed. Right. I haven't seen a tremendous change of the dynamic of the race so far. So you might think that pivot starts. And if the pivot starts, then it gives Brown, or actually it forces Brown to start pushing that, and Brown's supporters to start pushing that line more
vocally. Just that. I mean, it forces the Brown folks to spend some money. I mean, whether it comes from the Brown campaign as well. I mean, there's sort of a tough choice of the Brown folks. If the Whitman campaign starts running ads attacking Jerry Brown in April or in May, you know, does that speed up the timeline for some of this union money that we've heard about that's going to materialize on Brown's behalf? Does it accelerate that timeline for that money to drop, or does it force the Brown campaign to spend down some of its, you know, comparably paltry resources when you look at what Brown's up against in terms of unlimited resources with Whitman? And I think that becomes a real campaign tactical issue and a problem. Does Brown stand there and absorb the hits through the spring and not respond with paid media, or do Brown and his allies try to, you know, spend down some money and to try to cushion the blow from a hypothetical Whitman attack?
Well said.
So was it? I don't know. I halfway through the sentence, I started to think I wasn't making any sense.
Nah. You made perfect sense from my vantage point.
That's frightening.
April Fools. So let's move on to the other topic, which actually was generated by a listener to the podcast who asked what chatter is there about legislative races shaping up this year, and that, you know, we and others have talked a lot about congressional races and statewide races, but the legislative races seem to be operating a little under the radar. And, of course, as we all know, and we have all talked about a lot of times, the primary election in races for the legislature often becomes the most important race in a lot of districts, because the districts are so demonstrably Democratic or Republican that's really where the competition lies. Not to say that there aren't going to be competitive races in November, but the vast majority are not as competitive right in November as they are in June. So
right. With
that being said, Anthony York, man of the inside track at the Capitol in Los Angeles for this podcast, what are you watching?
Well, there are two special elections coming up, one in the Assembly and one in the Senate. In the Senate, there's a race to replace John Benoit, who's now on the Riverside County Board of Supervisors, race between Assemblyman Bill Emerson and former Assemblyman Russ Bogue. That's generated a lot of interest inside the Capitol.
And a lot of money in the independent expenditure world.
Right. The California Dental Association, a big Emerson booster. Emerson used to be the head of the dental pack. There's big money coming in on Emerson's behalf in that race. Emerson had to move into the district to run there, so there's been some controversy. And Bogue ran for the seat against Benoit and lost to John Benoit just a couple of years ago.
But that's that one, again, is just to hammer home the independent expenditure point for people who don't always watch this. It's a great example of how much money can flow into a campaign that's not really flowing into the candidates' campaigns, because and again, it's a factor of Prop 34, of the rules we have on the books. I mean, when you think of, you said it before, but the legislative limit for a contribution to a candidate's campaign is what, $6,500?
That's a statewide race. It's $3,900.
Oh, sorry, even worse. Yeah, thank you. $3,900 is the most you can give as an individual donor to an actual candidate. To the independent expenditure committees, as much as you want to give. And so we're seeing, you know, I mean, like a couple of $100,000 or something at least, traveling through some of these races.
Yeah, and similarly, in the 43rd Assembly District, the race to replace Paul Krikorian, who's now a member of the Los Angeles City Council, you have some of the IE money beginning to move in the race between, I'm going to butcher her name, Nayiri Nahabedian, I believe is the pronunciation, against Mike Gatto. Gatto is an attorney and a former staffer for Congressman Brad Sherman, and he has is going up against Nahabedian, who has support from, she's a member of the Glendale School Board, I believe, and has in her own local support. That's turned into a slugfest, and there's a weird quirk where the runoff for that election is also going to be the primary for the race. Now is to fill the rest of Paul Krikorian's term, which ends in December.
Right.
But then the runoff, the race, will be combined with the primary for the race. Anyway, it's one that I'm watching.
Well, and just to deviate for a moment to make a point about the world of special elections. I mean, this is off the top of my head, but it seems as though we've had a tremendous number of special elections for legislative seats, at least relative to other cycles this time around.
Yeah, and we could have another one if Abel Maldonado is confirmed as lieutenant governor,
of which we have about 6 more weeks left on his nomination. Tick tock.
April 22nd. I'm looking into my crystal ball.
Oh, as April 22nd is when we'll get a vote?
That's after April 22nd. Yes, that is my belief.
Okay. You want to tell people why?
Because that is the date that would after which the governor could consolidate the runoff for the special election with the November election. So it would save the counties involved. I believe there are 5 counties in that district some money. And Democrats believe it would boost their chances of winning the Senate seat. So that seems to be the tacit deal that has been struck, although we'll see.
We'll see. Briefly, any other legislative races that you, old learned man, are watching?
I don't know about learned, but... I'm watching a lot more closely in some of these Democratic primaries than the Republican primaries, because you're starting to see, as we always do this time of year, some of the IEs getting active, and what shapes up crudely as sort of labor Democrats versus business-friendly Democrats. And you have groups that often support Republican candidates playing in Democratic primaries through the independent expenditure process. There's a race in Santa Barbara. Susan Jordan, the wife of Assemblyman Pedro Nava, is running for Nava's seat against Doss Williams. That's been one that I'm watching.
Williams, we should say, is a city councilman in Santa Barbara.
Yes, and was originally seen as sort of the more pro-business Democrat, although he's received a lot of key labor endorsements over the last couple of weeks. Very interesting, very nasty race. Down in the South Bay, Los Angeles South Bay, the beach cities area, Redondo, Torrance, Hermosa Beach, places like that. 53rd Assembly District, a race with a lot of candidates, including Betsy Butler, who was a fundraiser for the trial attorneys. What are they called now? The civil...
I think that's the shorthand that'll work for us.
Lawyers is sort of there's a vague sort of a pejorative associated with that term, so I was trying not to use it.
They probably don't like it, like the corrections officers don't like to be called prison guards. But go ahead.
Betsy Butler, James Lau are among the field of candidates. That seems to be a lot of the action seems to be with those two candidates. Although we've seen before, you know, the Sacramento conventional wisdom is one thing, and sometimes it turns out to be something very different. On the Senate, again, down in the San Diego area, the race for Denise Ducheney's Senate seat between former Assemblyman Juan Vargas and current Assemblyman Mary Salas. That's another one where Vargas has a lot of business support, Salas has a lot of labor support, and has the support of the Senate leader, Daryl Steinberg. Let's see, where else? Oh, and in Sacramento, there's an interesting race that the number of different candidates, including Roger Dickinson, who's a county supervisor, City Councilman Kevin McCarty, and a couple of other candidates, Lauren Hammond, John Garland from the California Faculty Association, and the Faculty Association is coming in with a big independent expenditure committee on Garland's behalf. So those are a handful off the top of my head that are sort of interesting to watch, and keep watching at capitalweekly.net, capital with an O, as we will be doing our full rundown here in advance of the June primary.
You are just full of a plug before I could even say anything else. Come on. I'm just kidding. That's good. That's actually a really good rundown. And, you know, just to back up thematically a little bit or kind of issue based on a couple of things. One, I think you made a great point that really does kind of show what politics in California on the state capitol level is in legislative races. Again, this push and pull between liberal conservative business labor.
Yeah.
And people trying to influence that kind of ideological dynamic within the legislature. And then in the general election, of course, we're going to see a few races where the registration is very tight in a few districts. And especially if you look at places like the state Senate, and that's why that seat of Maldonado's is so important, too.
Right.
You get very, very close to Democrats getting the magic 27, the magic two-thirds supermajority of that chamber, which they think would change the dynamic in the Capitol for all kinds of issues.
Yeah, and it's interesting to note, too, you know, in June we're going to be voting on the open primary initiative or the top two initiative where rather than the top vote getter from each party advancing to the November runoff, the top two vote getters, regardless of party, would go to the runoff. And I think that would move a lot of the action. Right now, these districts are so safe. They're divided. There's such a stark partisan divides on most of these districts that a lot of these races are settled in June. And I think that if that initiative passes in June, that starting with the next cycle, with the 2012 election, a lot of the races, that June will almost be an afterthought, or it'll just be a... and there won't be a lot of drama to see who advances, and a lot of the real action will be in November. So, you know, it's something to consider for those of us who actually watch this stuff for a living.
Who actually do a living. I think that's
that's probably a small number. Probably that's just me.
Well, I was going to say, watching it for, you know, you have to define whether or not you can actually make a living out
hobby,
of this.
Hobby.
There you go.
Okay.
Avocation, vocation. We'll debate that later.
Yes, let's move that to another podcast.
Let's do, and let's end this podcast, I think, with that, and we'll let folks digest all of that, and then the legislature will be back next week off of their big Legislators Gone Wild spring break. I don't know why I keep saying that. I can't help myself.
Disturbing.
Enjoy the peanuts on the Southwest flight back.
Okay, and have a good holiday weekend.
That's true. It is Easter weekend coming up. That's Anthony York from Capital Weekly. I'm John Myers from KQED. We'll see you next time.